Is professional football a boys-only club? I'm Yvonne Macken, and for the BBC World Service, I'll be exploring the future of women's football. The 1970 World Cup in Mexico, with iconic players like Pelé, was my first exposure at the age of seven to the ceremony and excitement of the World Cup. Angola! Then, in 1974, despite my Anglo-Irish family not having a team to represent us at that World Cup, it was still a very special occasion.
Oh, a beautiful jumping from Troy.
My parents bought our first colour television so that we could watch the global spectacle.
Yeah, Buller makes history!
I've played and loved football since I was young, and I've watched men's football for over 40 years. I've been ashamed by the fact that I knew so little about the women's game or its players.
We've got a real contest on our hands now. The crowd are loving it.
Women's football took a stratospheric shift in the London 2012 Olympics. I don't think I ever dreamed I'd get to see an England-Brazil match played out at that hallowed Wembley Stadium with a 70,000 crowd. The atmosphere was fantastic, and it continued to grow during the tournament, culminating in the final between the USA and Japan.
The attendance here at Wembley tonight is 80,203, which is an Olympic record for a women's football match.
At first, I wasn't allowed to play football for my school. But thankfully, my football-mad headmaster, Mr. Lane, pushed the school's authorities to allow one girl to play in the boys' team. So I did eventually get to play for my school, and I was pretty good. My parents gave me some photos of me as a three-year-old, football in hand, playing with my brother in London, where we grew up. And it reminded me that nurture from a parent or sibling at a young age can seed a lifelong passion.
I started to play when I was 10.
Since I was 7 years old.
I started playing when I was about 3 years old.
We caught up with a number of young women pursuing their love of the game.
I'm Caitlin Updike from Broomfield, Colorado in the United States.
I'm Leah Sawai from Japan.
Alana Lamyok, originally from Trinidad and Tobago.
My name is Skur Maltese.
I'm from Akernes, Iceland.
My name is Francesca Kirby. I'm 21 years old.
I'm 26 years old.
I'm 21 years old.
25 years ago in Japan, it wasn't really common for the girls to play football.
I was one of the few girls in primary school that played amongst a bunch of boys.
The person that probably influenced me the most to keep going would be my sister.
My brother played a lot of football.
She threw me in front of the goal when I was a little kid.
Whenever he went to football training, I always went along and trained with the boys.
My brother tried to negotiate with a football coach to let me play with the team.
I joined Reading FC Academy at the age of 7.
I decided I want to play in college. You know, that's a dream come true for really any kid to be able to go play and get your college paid for.
I went through all the academy stages right up to now in the Reading FC women's setup.
After college, I looked for other opportunities, and that's how I ended up in Iceland.
I went to America to play because America is one of the best women's football team in the world.
Also involved in my first England camp in June for the Belarus and Ukraine World Cup qualifiers.
Currently playing professional soccer here in Akernes, Iceland.
I was invited to train with the Trinidad and Tobago National U20 team. We played a tournament in Suriname in South America. I actually captained the U20 team in that tournament. I was 18 years old at the time.
In spite of all the passion of players and improvements in skill, the fortune of women's football is mixed.
My name's Caitlin Fisher. I'm originally from Cambridge, Massachusetts. I currently live in Sao Paulo, Brazil. I was a professional football player here in Brazil, as well as in Sweden and the United States. I then pursued a master's in gender studies and international development at the London School of Economics. The Santos club, where Neymar was playing at the time, wanted to keep Neymar at Santos and to keep him in Brazil and prevent him from going over and signing with one of the large European clubs that he had been getting offers from. And so they increased his salary about tenfold and subsequently folded the entire women's team at Santos. About 1 month of Neymar's salary, 1.5 million reais, would have covered the cost of the entire women's team for the entire year. He actually had rallied some of his sponsors together to sponsor the women's team and got about a million reais together, and the rest just needed to be covered by the club, and the club said no, and so it was officially folded. It was a devastating moment for women's football, you know, really symbolic and deflating because, you know, people are saying this is the best club not only in Brazil but Latin America. If they can't make it, who can? This is January 2012. This is 6 months before the London Olympics. And these women had nowhere to play, no salaries, no team, and had to scramble to find something. The sentiment among female players in Brazil today is really one of pessimism, that the women's game was better off 8, 9, 10 years ago, where more large men's clubs had women's programs attached to them. Today, practically none do.
To understand the women's game, it's useful to look back at the origins of football for both sexes.
Women's football is pretty much similar to men's football in that it has both ancient and folk forms.
Jean Williams is a senior research fellow at the International Centre for Sports History and Culture at De Montfort University in the UK.
In 2003, I wrote the first published academic history of women's football. Football's always been slightly contentious. Various kings, clergy and noblemen have banned it at various stages, although we do know that Henry VIII had a pair of football boots. There is some evidence that women were playing in the 1600s, both in England and in the United States. One of the things that's significant about women's football is that we know about the earliest games in 1881. The next significant series of matches were those run by the British Ladies Football Club, run by player secretary Nettie Honeyball and Lady Florence Dixie. This made national newspapers. We should see this as a serious intention to establish women's football. So the British Ladies Football Club played over 100 matches from Belfast to Newcastle to London. The next real burst of interest in women's football comes with the First World War, as women moved into the munitions factories. There were also Lions Tea Houses teams, and teachers and secretaries and nurses also played football. This period is particularly interesting because the women were local stars but also national stars, featured in the big daily newspapers and on Pathé newsreels.
From the early part of the 20th century, women's football was prohibited in parts of the world. It was effectively a rule that set the women's game back 50 years and was only lifted in the 1970s. The power and finance of men's football is complicated, but it's a useful parallel when looking at the sustainability of the women's game. Men's football is big business, but unlike other businesses, it doesn't seem to be an economically rational one. There is also the question of whether, in a team sport, individual players should really be treated as a commodity. The buying and selling of players can lose clubs millions.
Many, many clubs in Europe do not provide any financial information publicly, and we think that's fundamentally wrong.
Steve Clapham has set up a business that analyses the finances of the Premier League.
Nobody but the club and UEFA knows how much they've spent, so nobody can judge whether the rules have been correctly applied. And surely the local communities and the fans have got a right to know how much the clubs are investing in the local community and in the future of the team. After all, that is the future of the national team. The average Premier League player earns £1.3 million a year. And I'm sure most people listening to this programme will be on a salary which is closer to £26,000 a year than £26,000 a week. And this just reflects the, you know, the value of the TV rights. Yeah, I'm not against Wayne Rooney getting paid £50 million or £70 million. I mean, I have to defend that because I'm a capitalist and I believe that the market sets the fair price. However, what I do believe is that it's in the long-term interests of the game that the differentials shouldn't get too wide.
Boys and girls around the world share a love for the game. The difference at the moment is that a young boy in many countries has a route to a global footballing career with the potential to earn a good living. Young girls aren't afforded that, or even close to the same career path.
If I could make a living out of playing soccer, that would be the dream, of course.
If I could make a career out of football and make a success out of it, I definitely would. My name's Chloe, I'm 18. I've always been in London. Since I was young, I always had this ambition that I would help my mum. I don't know, I just think she kind of deserves it. So the promise I made trying to get the house for me and my mum, that's always been a promise.
Chloe is an example of how clubs are helping in their community.
To be honest, my background is complicated kind of thing. I got brought up in care. I started doing football from the age of 9. It's like solved all my problems. Like whenever I did it, I'd have no stress on my shoulders.
In the UK, Arsenal's employability programme, set up in 2012, supports 18 to 24-year-olds in finding work.
There's this guy called Jack Ferguson. He's a part of the Arsenal community, and Jack always pulls me in for little chats and finds out what I'm doing. If I'm not doing nothing, then he asks me what do I like to do. As I've got older, literally, I could do anything. I'd love to play for England. I've heard that trials are coming up soon, but they haven't told me what team that want me, so I just gotta sit back and wait.
Recently, the chief executive of the Bundesliga Germany, Christian Seifert, highlighted the fact that German clubs are voluntarily sacrificing extra ticket revenue in order to preserve the bonds with their community, to fill stadiums and ultimately to continue the growth of the game in their country, allowing as many people as possible of all ages and social backgrounds to go to stadiums. The emphasis seems slightly different in the UK's Premier League. Anna Kessel is a sports writer for The Guardian and Observer newspapers and is chair of a networking organisation called Women in Football.
We have a paradox here in that the elite end of football is the richest it's ever been. Players are earning the most that they've ever earned. We've got the biggest global audiences, the biggest sponsorship deals. And yet, it doesn't make sense because the tickets are also the most expensive they've ever been. You know, it's supposed to be a working class sport, and how are people supposed to afford these enormous costs of going to football? And when you look at the participation numbers at the grassroots end of football, they've dropped last year by 11%. So we're watching more football than ever, but we're playing it less than ever. So something is going massively wrong. I think we've become quite distracted by making the Premier League, branding it as the greatest league in the world. It doesn't matter if you're a great footballer or not. Everybody has weak moments. Everybody falls on tough times, whether it's through injury, whether it's through someone trying to take advantage of all the money that you have and making you sign an awful contract that effectively makes you give away part of your income for the rest of your life and therefore ends up bankrupting you. You know, whatever it is, even the best footballers do have weaknesses and we need to support them. And it's another example of why perhaps football would benefit from having more women in it.
New Zealander Jane Dennehy, now living in the UK, is founder and director of the Gender Hub, which did research into the British newspaper coverage of the London 2012 Olympics.
Following our research on the Olympics and the findings that women's coverage isn't the same or close to that of men's, one way of possibly addressing this is getting public broadcasters to commit to showing all the national teams and their results on the national news. And I think that this is a way of really underpinning the idea that you can't be what you can't see. In New Zealand, football was always seen as a bit of a girly sport, frankly, and women certainly, if they did play, it was pretty much on the margins as well. What's interesting is how much that's changed in 30 years. New Zealand women have been playing well in the qualifiers for the World Cup, and the men, although they didn't qualify, have been doing pretty well in the regional tournaments. And that's probably epitomised by seeing that the Under-20s World Cup is going to be hosted in New Zealand next year, which certainly sort of disrupts the idea that New Zealand is just about rugby, racing and beer.
We invest 50-50 back into professional game through academies in the FA Cup, and then 50% goes back into the national game. So all of our kind of investments really into children's, grassroots, semi-professional football.
Kelly Simmons is director of the National Game and Women's Football at the Football Association.
The Game Changer is the FA's plan for the development of the women's game. And there's some key priorities in that we've made some big progress on. One of the things we said we'd do is that we'd continue to invest in and we'd expand the Women's Super League. So we've created a second division and very recently we announced our plans to expand the Women's Super League by linking the promotion from the existing Women's Premier League. We've created a new elite unit at St George's Park to look at young player development and the development of coaches in the women's game as part of our ambitions to have a successful England side. We've appointed head of elite development. We're just appointing 7 regional coach developers who are going to work in our centres of excellence for girls across the country, making sure that we've got a really strong talent pathway. So we're really pleased with that too. And it also outlines our ambitions around growing the game, getting more girls to play in schools, more girls to play in clubs, more women to play the game. Before we started the Women's Super League, the game was amateur in the sense that they were non-contract, non-paid players. Ultimately, well, the very reason of being able to pay those players and in our ambition about the WSL is all about creating professional women's football so that our best players can become full-time. I think we can become professional over the next 2-3 years at the top level. The salary cap has been put in place in the Women's Super League and we review it every year. It's 40% of the club's turnover can be used for salaries. And the reason we've done that is because we want the clubs to develop the infrastructure around them to be able to move on and become professional clubs. So that means we can't spend all the money on players at the moment if we haven't got the right commercial expertise, the right marketing expertise, the right operations behind it, high quality coaches, sports science, sports medicine. Ultimately, these are our England players, our England youth players. So all of the things that you'd want in terms of a good club and an environment that you'd want to put your elite players into, we've got to make sure through the club licence that's all in place. And that'll give the game a chance to grow and develop.
The women's game is growing in popularity across the world.
If we look at countries like Egypt, for instance, the women's football movement started out back in the early 1990s with the likes of Dr. Sahar El Hawari. She paved the way for more women and girls to play football at a grassroots level in Egypt. It also resulted in opportunities for more and more women and girls to play competitively at an international level, and that has been fantastic. My name is Dr. Samaya Farooq Sami. I am currently an affiliate scholar at the Centre for Sport, Peace and Society at the University of Tennessee, USA. I am a British Muslim of South Asian Pakistani heritage. I am also the daughter of a Muslim imam and I am an avid supporter of women's sport.
My name is Aisha Nasanga. I'm based in Kampala, Uganda. I am a sports journalist and I work on both radio and TV. I kicked a ball once or twice when I was growing up, but we were not encouraged, really. That was not a girl's game. My dad was a professional footballer who played for the national team, and as a young child, I had to attend almost every one of his games, and that's how I picked interest in the sport. The level of interest of women's sport in general is very low, or barely there in most of the country, and in South Africa, it's a bit better because they've played at the World Cup before. The West African nations still rule in terms of football because they've got the strongest teams. The Black Maidens from Ghana have been to World Championships before and they are going to be at a World Cup as well. Nigeria as well do have quite a strong team that have played at World Cups before and are able to contest against some of the big sides like the USA, like Germany, and like Brazil, and they do have a lot more professionals who are eventually admitted in American universities. That way, get to hone their skills even better. There have been different programs that have come up, including the Airtel Rising Stars that encourages both boys and girls to compete in tournaments at a younger stage, as well as Copa Coca-Cola, which is hoping to introduce a girls' tournament as well. That way, you'll have more girls participating this time around.
There are still, I think, challenges that women have to kind of deal with on a day-to-day basis. Some of those include a lack of role models to not really having any money. So women who give up their jobs to play football professionally often have to compete without getting paid, for instance. We also have the fact that many still have to battle with the idea of having to wear shorts. And I think this is an issue not for all Muslim girls, but certainly for some Muslim girls that want to adhere to certain notions of Muslim femininity. If we look at Jordan, for instance, Jordan currently has one of the top female football teams. They have a lot of support from very powerful men in the country. They've played, I think, quite a critical role in challenging FIFA's 2007 imposed hijab ban that prevented the 2010 Iranian women's football team from participating in the finals of the 2010 Youth Games in Singapore. I think in addition to that, the ban prevented many other Muslim women from engaging in football, not only at a grassroots level, but definitely at an international competitive level. The ban itself, I think it legitimized the discrimination and the harassment of veiled women in football all around the world. But that being said, I think it's important to recognize that it didn't necessarily stop all Muslim women and all Muslim girls who wanted to veil from playing a game that they definitely loved. Many cleverly invented new designs. You know, they were wearing bandanas and they were wearing different styles of hoods to be able to compete. Moving on, I guess if we look at Qatar, Qatar will be the first Arab state to host the World Cup in 2022. And I think it's fair to say that this has in some ways fueled their commitments to try and boost women's football in the Arab world. The island of Zanzibar, for instance, a team called the New Generation Queens has gained a lot of publicity, especially in the West, for inspiring more and more women and girls to actually engage in football, despite the kinds of hardships that women on the island face. Add to this the worry that playing sport will have on their chances of getting married. Women clearly have had to overcome a lot.
It's unfortunate that the exposure and funding isn't enough where the female football is concerned in Trinidad. Even though we continue to impress frequently across all levels, we recently had the National U20 women's team. They had an impressive showing in their CONCACAF championship tournament. They didn't make it through to the World Cup, but we were very proud of them. You know, they made history.
One thing that you see not only in Brazil and other countries as well is placing the women's game before a men's game, before a large men's game, a championship game, you know, and calling fans earlier to the stadium to come and watch the women's game. And, you know, you'll get fans that wouldn't necessarily go to a women's game that have never seen a women's game before and are exposed to it. So it definitely heightens visibility. Something really interesting that we've seen in Brazil between 2008, 2012, when the Santos Club really invested in their women's team. And during that period, the men's Santos team wasn't doing as well as they had historically. So we started to see the fans from the men's game come over and start supporting the women's Santos team. They were Santos fans called Santistas. And this was interesting because it really transcended gender. You know, they said it doesn't matter if it's men or women playing out there representing Santos. Really reflecting the value of club brand, club loyalty. And, you know, I think that also says a lot in terms of starting a new league. You know, in the U.S., you create a new league and you create a new team out of nothing. It takes time to build that brand loyalty to this made up new club. So if you're building off a club that already has a fan base, whether it be a men's team or a women's team, I think there's something there. You know, you have the argument that the women's game is slower, weaker, therefore not as exciting. And that equates to, well, you can't build a fan base. And if you can't build a fan base, then you have no market for your game. And so it's obvious that there won't really be the ability for a sustainable professional women's league, period. The conversation ends there. Is it really a weaker version of the men's game, or do we have a different interpretation of the same game here? You know, does that mean that it's any less technical or skillful? Very interestingly, in Brazil, you would have a lot of male fans of the men's game argue that after they've seen the women's game, they actually really enjoy it. And many fans actually have said they enjoy it more than the men's game, which they say the women's game today reminds them of this earlier era of Brazilian football, this quote-unquote ginga, this rhythm, this creativity, this spontaneity that was more reminiscent of Pelé's era.
Fran Kirby was selected for her England international debut against Sweden. She not only scored a goal, but she was awarded player of the match.
With it being quite an enclosed stadium, I think you could kind of feel how close they were. And every time we'd go forward, you could hear the crowd growing with you and wanting you to do well. So they were really good, and there was loads of chanting going on, and yeah, it was a great atmosphere. I was quite nervous, to say the least. I was excited as well. I think I had a bit of both, which was good. The girls were really good with me. They kind of just came up to me and said, there's no pressure. Go and do what you've been doing in training. Just make sure you enjoy it. Being my first game, I don't think people expected me to score or even get player of the match. So I think that contributed massively to people writing to me on Twitter saying, well done. And obviously, if I hadn't scored or if I hadn't got player of the match, it probably wouldn't have been that big. But yeah, definitely wasn't ready for it. And yeah, it's just very surreal.
Mm-hmm. and other international players are looking forward with great excitement to the 2015 World Cup in Canada. They are determined to show there is a great future for women's football.
If Brazil and the CBF, the Football Federation, was really smart right now, they would turn and say, look, we have a World Cup and it's a year away. And this same canary yellow, this uniform that just performed out here and represented our country, is going to take to international stage again with the best female player in the world. And really an opportunity to reinstill a sense of collective pride and nationalism back through the game. And I think that it's a huge opportunity, and the Brazilian Football Federation would be really missing out if they didn't dedicate some energy to that.
Well, with my FIFA Women's Committee hat on, they're going very well. There's a lot of excitement in Canada. I think it'll be a really fantastic event for women's football and women's sport.
We have another FIFA World Cup that's happening next year in Canada, 2015, and hopefully we get supporters and people out there and watching it.
We're currently in a camp in Houston training for our regional qualifiers that are coming up. And then hopefully once we get past that stage, which we usually do, we can make it to the CONCACAF, where we meet up the giants like the US and Mexico, where it gets a little more tough. But I have hope that they'll do well. You know, the passion is still there. 2015 World Cup Canada, here we come.
The Future of Women's Football was produced by Yvonne Macken and is a Sue Clark production for the BBC World Service.